Hi everyone, welcome to How Can I Heal podcast with Krina Okumus. This is an interview series with people that I admire and really made a change in my life. We are exploring questions about life, dreams, how can I be more happy and healthy, and learn how can we deal with pressure or challenges in the private or professional life. I really hope you take a nugget of wisdom or two and you are improving your own life for the better. Aging, one of the life's inevitable certainties, has been a hot topic of research for a number of years. From obvious fable stories promising the elixir of life to the questionable anecdotes of individuals who swear by supplements or regimens, anti-aging has always appeared to be a wild goose chase. But now, scientists may be closer than they ever been to identify anti-aging agents. Stanford University's professor Tony Weiss-Corey has led a milestone in the research by what is known as blood rejuvenation. I really hope this discussion will inspire you as much as did to me and learn more if we can or not reverse the aging process.
Yeah, so what people find, especially in old individuals, those who live to a very long life, they often have a strong social network and social bonds. And people who are isolated and alone, they tend to get depressive. They don't see a sense in their life anymore. And that affects the immune system, it affects the body, and it becomes susceptible to other diseases and ages much faster.
And now, let's get to my conversation with the professor, Tony Weiss-Corey. Thank you so much, Tony, for joining this conversation.
Very nice to be here.
It's really a big honor, Tony. You know, before this interview, I was thinking, and I'm super curious. First of all, my first question, which probably you are not expecting it. What did you eat for breakfast?
Oh, that's a great question. because I just had, my mother sent me Lebkuchen. You know, what is this? It's gingerbread, yeah, that's the name in English.
Wow.
Yeah, and so we had the last gingerbread from Christmas left over, yeah.
Nice.
And two coffee, yeah.
I was very curious as well to really understand a little bit, if you can tell us, what are the main activities that you are doing during the day? Because everything what you are doing, somehow I could see just in the movies, honestly. So if you can just tell us a little bit the activities that you are doing during the day.
Your main activities. As a scientist, you mean?
As a scientist, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so in my role, I lead a lab of about 30 people at a university. And as a professor, I do some teaching. That varies dependent on your employment at the university. So I do very little teaching to students directly in a classroom setting. But most of what I do now is discuss with the people in my lab, which is composed of students, graduate students, some undergraduates, college students who take research as an additional class, postdoctoral fellows. So these are scientists who have finished their doctoral degree and work for a few more years in research. I talk with them about their projects. We plan the experiments that we want to do. And then we might write publications together. So then I'm involved in writing and editing manuscripts, editing figures, making suggestions, and then also writing proposals to foundations or to government organizations to get funding for our research. And then the third part is giving presentations giving talks or interviews like this one. So it's really three parts, raising money, advertising what we do, and then actually doing and translating the ideas that we have.
Wow, that's quite a lot. And I think it's quite impressive for taking into consideration what the honors, the awards, and everything what you achieve until now. And definitely you had a long and outstanding career as a research scientist. Can you tell us a little bit more about... No, I mean, that's true. I mean, I just saw the list with all the honors and awards that you had, and I'm really impressed, honestly. I'm very curious if you can tell us a little bit more about what your work is on and some of the highlights of your career until now.
Yeah, so maybe if I start sort of at the beginning, I was interested in how the immune system works in the brain, or how the immune system of the body interacts with the brain. And that was in part because very little was known when I entered my career. It was known that in a disease called multiple sclerosis that many of you may know, that the immune system seems to attack parts of the insulation that nerve cells use to communicate with each other, and people get paralyzed over time. And that's as a result of the immune system attacking basically itself. It called this an autoimmune disease. But other than that, there wasn't really that much known of how the immune system may interact with the brain and how that changes with age. And I was particularly interested in Alzheimer's disease and age-related neurodegeneration, because there were indications that these old brains looked inflamed, that there was some sort of an inflammation taking place, but it wasn't clear what this was and whether it was to some extent beneficial or detrimental. And so that's where we started to use models to understand that, but then also brain tissue from people who passed away from disease. And we really were interested in how the immune system in the rest of the body interacts with the brain. And that led us to study the blood and the composition of the blood to see whether changes in the blood could tell us something about changes in the brain. And we discovered that, first of all, as people get older, as animals get older, the composition of their blood, specifically proteins in the blood, and there's thousands of different ones, they change dramatically as you get older. In fact, they change so much that we can take a blood sample from a person and we can tell you pretty much with pretty high accuracy how old you are approximately within a few years. And we think that difference actually tells us whether you're aging faster or slower than the average. But these changes suggested that the body lives in a really different environment, and also the brain, because the brain is, of course, very highly vascularized, uses a large amount of the blood every second. Blood pumps through the brain, and the brain is one of the most highly demanding organs in terms of blood supply. So the question was, if the composition of the blood changes that dramatically with age, how does that affect the brain? And is it possible that if we would change the composition of the blood from an old organism back to a young, that would actually be beneficial? And that's indeed what we found. We found that you can take the blood of a young mouse and inject that into an old mouse and sort of rejuvenate this old mouse, especially... From our interest, from our perspective, you can rejuvenate the brain. The mice become smarter again. They have less inflammation. Their stem cells start to make new neurons again. And overall, the animal does better, suggesting that these factors that accumulate with age are detrimental and they could potentially be exchanged. And that was really, I think, the biggest discovery that we made about, it's almost 10 years ago now when we published this. And since then, we have really tried to understand how does this work and translate it to humans.
That's really impressive, and congratulations for that. I mean, it's really revolutionary what you are saying now. Where we are now with the research? Like now, you move from the mouses into the human beings.
Yeah. So the mouse studies. And we were not the only one who did these. We were the first one to study the brain. But a good friend of mine, Tom Randall, who is also here at Stanford, first tested this effect on the muscle because he was interested in muscle degeneration with aging. And he could show that young blood can rejuvenate old muscle in mice. But we were really interested in potentially translating that to humans and started a company. It's called Alkahest, after Paracelsus, who is actually hails from Switzerland. And Paracelsus was the first to describe sort of that the dose of something makes it a poison or a treatment, a beneficial treatment. He was also an alchemist and thought that if you can figure out the composition of something, you can put it back together and understand its individual components. And thinking inspired me to use that same name, because when we look at blood, as I mentioned before, there's thousands and thousands of different components, different proteins, but also other types of molecules, and of course, blood cells. And it's almost like, you know, you could call it the elixir of life, the essence of life. And people, of course, always put a very special notion to blood, and there are all kinds of stories about rejuvenation and fresh blood, young blood, and things like that in every language. But what we try to do is really to see whether we can take this complex mixture and put it into individual parts, understand which parts are detrimental, which parts are beneficial. And by starting a company, we could start testing this in humans and really see whether this is potentially translatable. And so thus far, we have been able to, first of all, work with another company that is in what is called the blood plasma business. So they collect blood donations from volunteers, and then they make blood products that patients may need who have no antibodies, that are immunodeficient, for example, or that are hemophiliacs, that, you know, where their blood doesn't coagulate, so they get this factor 8 that is missing. And with them together, we were able to look at different components of the blood, and we found one fraction of the blood that went into two clinical trials now, one in Alzheimer's disease and one in Parkinson's disease, and they look promising. They're not yet at the stage where we have enough data for clinical approval, but they look quite promising at this early stage.
But do you believe that we can reverse the aging process?
That's a great question. And it's almost a philosophical question. First of all, you know, what is aging and why do we age?
Why do we age? I wanted to ask you that. Why do we age?
Yeah, it's a,
and
it's
I would
a
love
great
to
question.
Tell
we
me, I would love to tell me a formula, something that we can just do something that we are not aging, or at least, I don't know.
Slowing it down, yeah.
Slowing yeah. down, exactly.
Yeah.
But please tell me. I think everyone wants to hear this this answer from you, so I don't want to interrupt
you. No, I you know, we don't have an answer really why we age. The best answer we have is, first of all, there's pretty good evidence that there is no genetic program of aging. So it's not written in our DNA that we are supposed to age, or that we are supposed to die after 40 or 50 years on the planet. We haven't found such evidence in, and when I say we, the scientific community, in any organism, whether it's a fly. A lot of studies have been done with flies to study aging, with worms even, with mice. There is no gene that causes aging. So the best explanation is we age like a car ages. If you produce a model car, right, the factory produces tens of thousands of the same model, and you hope they don't put something in there that makes the car break down after 10 years. We don't think they do. So if that car is being produced, you know, it has a certain lifespan that is determined by how much it is used, how much wear and tear, oxidation, you know, from the environment, depending on where you live. Maybe it's salt that destroys, you know, the car. And some cars will last only for a short time, and some part breaks and you basically throw them away. And others live very long, and you can keep them for, you know, 30, 40 years, especially if conditions are ideal, such as here in California. You see some cars that, you know, are 40, 50 years old and are being driven all the time. So the best explanation is that aging of biological systems is similar. It's based on, first of all, the purpose of the organism. And, you know, this is really speaking in a strictly biological sense, is to reproduce and maintain the species. That's what we call the evolutionary pressure to survive. And based on the organism and this evolutionary pressure, the species needs to live a certain amount of time to reproduce. Some species can reproduce very quickly. So then if the offspring is independent, the parents are essentially no longer needed. Humans have a very low reproduction period, and it's about 30 to 40 years until the next generation is really completely independent. And so after that period of time, after 30 to 40 years, you really start to see at the molecular level very profound changes of aging occur. Those are not usually felt as a person yet, and they're not even observed that much typically. But molecularly, in the composition of blood, we actually see dramatic changes at around 30 to 40 years of age. And then after that, most organs, most tissues start to show clear signs of aging that continue until, you know, average lifespan is now 80 years of age. So 50% of the population will be dead at age 80, and then it goes very fast down. Average maximum lifespan is maybe 110, 120. But why we age is really, I think, mostly due to the environment and the use, wear and tear of the organism.
So do you think that...
Now, your second question was, can we slow down or reverse this process?
Yes, please.
I think we will be able to. And again, this is completely technical, and this has, of course, a lot of ethical and moral implications. But if we think about a system that would last forever, then I think it would be a system that can self-renew, a biological system. If you take a rock, for example, even though it seems a rock lives for a long time, it doesn't last forever. The elements will ultimately put it into sand, and then maybe through pressure it becomes a rock again. But everything on this planet eventually ends and degrades, except life. Life is a biological system that can reproduce and can basically maintain itself. Now, it's not in the same organism, but we know that the germ cells, so the sperm and the egg, they, by definition, they have age zero when a new human being is being generated, right? Because every generation, the child starts at age zero. So that means somehow the biological system, even in a human, is able to keep the reproductive cells without aging. And we're still trying to figure out how this works, but there seems to be a way that these cells can maintain themselves in a very pristine condition, or that they can actually erase at the time before they fuse and form a new organism, that they can erase aspects of aging. And so the basic question whether age could be extended and a biological system can be maintained so that it doesn't age is yes. It's even possible to reverse aging. We know from a Nobel Prize work by Shinya Yamanaka, who about 15 years ago, so maybe 20 years ago, showed that you can take any cell of your body, and this is often done with skin cells, and you can reprogram them to age zero. You can make a stem cell out of these cells. So you can completely erase all the age that has accumulated in a cell, in a dish, and make it age zero again. So in principle, it is possible to erase age, to reverse age, or to maintain something at the same age. Now, technically, it's not possible to do this in a complex organism yet, and we may never be able to do it entirely. We may be able to do aspects of it, but because a complex organism such as a human, especially a human brain, they're so complex that it may be challenging to completely maintain them at the same age or erase all aspects of aging again. It's a long answer.
No, but I think it's a very important one, and I'm happy to hear that it's a possibility. So thank you so much for that. I'm very curious to know your opinion about how important is into this, the whole aging, reversing aging process. How do you think it's the lifestyle important into that? What you eat, sport?
How important are those parts? Yeah, I think, again, coming back to the analogy of the car, you can destroy a car pretty quickly by, you know, abusing it. And I think you can destroy a human body by abusing it and age faster. And that abuse can, of course, we wouldn't call it abuse, but a disease also ages the body. Often people who have chronic diseases age faster, or even infectious diseases. People with HIV, they tend to age faster on average if we look at their tissues. So at the same time, you can live a healthy life, and by exercising, for example, eating healthy food, there's pretty good evidence, even from animal studies, that this maintains the body at a healthier, state. And by definition, that slows down the aging process to some extent. It's not dramatic. And of course, you still have a set of genes that you cannot change. And while there's no gene that tells the body to age, the genes you have determine how you respond to the challenges around you. So I'm not sure if that makes sense, but there are people who have better repair processes than others. And you might see this most obviously in the skin. So there's people who can repair their skin up to a very old age, very efficiently, and they have smooth and young skin, and others can't do that, and their skin ages much faster. And while exposure to sun, for example, could accelerate the aging process, you're still, to a large extent, limited by the genes that you have been given, how you respond to the environments. So you can, for the body you have, for the genes you have, you can definitely have an impact on how much you accelerate the aging process or potentially slow it down. But maybe that's within a few years that you can manipulate there. And it's definitely not decades, because we know from large population studies where people don't have time to care what they eat because they just have to survive, that it does not matter that much what the average lifespan is. Now, that doesn't mean you should not care about it again, because in an advanced society where you have the luxury to take care of your body, you can, as I said, probably affect this about a few years, and then especially also how healthy you are before you die. And that's, of course, one of the things that we hope to target first, sort of what we call health span rather than lifespan.
So you mentioned that the genes are very important. You mentioned that this is basically part of it, but after that, it's what you eat. The sun can influence. Is it something else that we can add on the list that could influence the aging?
People often die. We all know these stories where a couple lives together and one of them dies, and then soon after the other one dies as well. Why would that be? It is often because they were so dependent on each other and connected in a good way, but maybe also to an extent where they had no contact with other people or very little, that their life basically ended when their partner left and they didn't see a sense in living anymore. So maybe that is even a bigger driver, especially in humans. In animals, we can't test that. But in humans, the spirit, how we call it, or the energy to live and the outlook on life is so incredibly important. If people are depressed, they become susceptible to diseases, and again, that accelerates aging and can lead to cancer, but also to other chronic diseases and shortens lifespan. So maybe that's actually the biggest factor. And that's, of course, hard to manipulate because it's, again, to some extent in your genes what your overall sort of outlook is on life. There are people who are very outgoing and enthusiastic and they have a lot of joy of life, or however you want to call it, and others are maybe more subdued and more cynical or depressed, and to some extent that's who we are, or maybe even how we grew up and who sort of how childhood imprinted our brains and how we see the world.
That's terrible, because keeping the consideration the actual situation that we are now, when we are more and more isolated due to the coronavirus.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is moving so much into this direction.
Right. Yeah. No, I think it certainly is not helping. It certainly is not helping people who are already isolated in, you know, retirement homes, and then they can't even see their family anymore. You know, to maintain sort of the will to live is very hard in that situation, but also for anybody else, of course, who doesn't have contact anymore or has to limit contact very strongly now. Yeah, we're not made for that, that's for sure. We're a social animal, as they say.
Wow, that's a big one, and I hope we are going out very soon from this. What is your opinion, if you can tell me a little bit more about how do you see the future of the COVID-19 situation? What is your opinion about this topic?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's two possibilities. One is we agree as a culture, as a society, to just let the virus run through and let the fittest survive. Or we say we have to find a tool, and the tool, a treatment against the virus, and that treatment is a vaccine. There's no other, these are the two possibilities. And I think as developed societies, the former possibility is just not acceptable. I think we can't just say those who are weak should die from this virus, even if it's only 1%. I mean, in the United States, that would be 3.5 million people would die. And I think that's just not acceptable. So we have to be patient, and hopefully people participate in the vaccinations and don't make up all kinds of theories about being tagged by the government and all kinds of crazy things. I think we need a vaccine like we eradicated polio or other diseases. That's the only way out.
But do you think that there are enough data to really understand this virus?
There are enough data to understand how the virus infects people. I don't think there's enough data to know how it spreads exactly, about these super spreaders, how they're called, or under what exact circumstances it spreads faster or slower. And I think, you know, that's not that important to know. The fact is that if you let the virus run its course without any protection, it will pretty quickly infect most people. And we know that roughly 1% will die, or potentially even more. And that's the bottom line that counts. We don't know what the long-term consequences are. I mean, there's some people who say, well, I better be infected by a natural virus than
getting an artificial vaccine that I don't know what it does. I find this really very unreasonable because we don't know what the long-term consequences of the virus are. This virus has been around for a year, a bit more, 1.5 years maybe. And it's possible that you get long-term consequences and reactivation in the brain that leads to nerve damage. And as we see in some individuals who are susceptible to, maybe this genetically susceptible to getting CNS symptoms, brain symptoms. So I think we don't know, we certainly don't know enough about long-term consequences because the virus hasn't been around long enough. But we see all kinds of different manifestations in people who are infected. There are people who don't recover from the virus. They just, it comes and goes for them. They have been in hospitals multiple times. And when they think they recovered, it sort of comes back again, because once you have the virus inside you, it will go into hiding, but it can reactivate again. This is the same like most people are probably familiar with fever blisters that you can get, right? This is a virus that you get as a child, and you usually overcome it, but once it gets reactivated in stress situations or when you have a fever, it breaks out again. And it can cause shingles in people where you scratch your skin to almost go crazy, or you get zoster around your GERD, which is incredibly painful. And these are examples of viruses that are dormant for decades, and they become reactivated and can cause disease again. So we don't know what's going to happen with COVID-19, but it seems, you know, people respond differently to it, and the best is to avoid it or to vaccinate, and then you don't get the virus. It can't take hold.
Thank you so much for your answer, Tony. I have a curiosity. I saw one of your presentation that you think that around 2030, there will be 75 million Alzheimer's worldwide.
Yeah.
And for me, this it was like a shock number. Can you develop a little bit more about this topic?
Yeah, so Alzheimer's disease is a disease of the aging brain. There's two forms, principally. There's one that is a genetic form, where people have a mistake in their DNA, and as a consequence, they develop this disease anywhere from age 25 to 60 or 70. And there's maybe one in 10,000 people, roughly, has these genetic forms of Alzheimer's disease. Everybody else has the non-genetic form. And that's very strongly age-dependent. There's some genetic risk factors that we know that increase your risk by up to tenfold to get the disease. But it's really a disease of the elderly. And because the fastest segment of the population worldwide are older people above 65, there's just many more people around who live to become susceptible to this disease. And in the past, you know, if you look at life expectancy, especially in less developed nations, most people would not live that long that they would ever get this disease. And so it was simply not known. But as we all live longer, we become, unfortunately, highly susceptible to losing our cognitive abilities. And as that progresses, it becomes a disease that we call dementia, or a symptom that we call dementia, where you can't actually interact with people anymore in the end. And you can't make any new memories, and you really can't function anymore. But it's not that this is a new disease. It's just, well, it is new in a way, but it's because we live long enough to experience it. It's like many other age-related diseases that were much less common because people didn't live that long. So it's simply a number game, because more people live to an old life, more will have Alzheimer's disease if we don't have a treatment.
Let's move a little bit into the more optimistic way. How do you see the future, yeah, let's say in 2050, into the most optimistic side, if we say optimistic? How do you see in this direction, how we will be in 2050?
Yeah, so from an aging perspective, from a health perspective,
exactly.
You're asking.
Correct.
And that, of course, yeah, and even here, I'm reading tea leaves. I think we have made incredible progress over the past 10 years in our understanding of biological processes because of huge technological advances and also computational advances that allow us to look at ever larger sets of biological data. I think we will start to be able to slow down aspects of aging, potentially even reverse them, to hopefully have people not live longer, but live healthier until they die. Sort of what a lot of centenarians, people who live to 100 years, many of them are quite healthy. Now, they're not running around like spring chicken, but they don't have these age-related diseases. Many of them are quite in good shape. They can live independent. They are just healthy. And so we know that this is possible with the human body. And this is, I think, where we're going to make inroads, that we will be able to push some of these age-related diseases further and further out, so that you don't have Alzheimer's disease for 20 years or 15 years. And in the end, you're completely demented. But hopefully we can push this out so that you don't get this disease. And I think in general, you know, we will continue to make progress in fighting cancer and other diseases. Of course, it will become more challenging because the problems that we have left become more and more complicated. We solve the easier problems first, and we're left with more and more complex problems. But I think, you know, in the next 10, 20, or even 30 years, I think we will be able to tackle some of these more complex diseases. I don't know if we will live even longer. I think that's a much bigger challenge, and I don't think that's a challenge we should tackle. I don't think we should try to live longer necessarily. But we should try to achieve good health until 80, 90, or 100, if that's our lifespan.
Okay, let's hope this is moving into this direction. My last question, Tony. If we are going back into the past, to the little Tony, and if it will be an advice that you will tell to yourself, taking into consideration the experience that you achieve until now, what will be one advice, and what will be one thing that maybe you will change, if it will be one thing that you will change in your decision?
You mean if I could give myself advice
Yeah, if you
for the future, or
if you are going back in time and you meet with Tony, that he's a kid, what will be one advice that you will give him, taking into consideration your experience that you have until now, and if it will be one thing that you will change during your life decisions, one of the decisions.
Oh wow, these are deeply philosophical questions.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I'm very curious.
Yeah.
So what will be?
What would I tell myself?
What will be one advice that you will tell to yourself?
I think, I had such a good life, you know. I don't think I could tell myself to. I don't think I would tell myself to do something different necessarily. I think I would tell myself, take the opportunities that are presented to you. Maybe spend more time with friends and family. But that's, of course, always, it's always a, you know, at every time in your life, you make decisions, and every minute in your life, you make decisions, right? And
right.
And you never know how they come out. You could imagine. I mean, for us, it was a really big decision to go to the United States and work here. Yeah, from Switzerland. And if I hadn't taken that decision, and if my wife had said, you know, I don't want to go, I would have a completely different life. I wouldn't be talking to you on the phone now.
Maybe we will be neighbors.
I know that for sure. But yeah, it would be something completely different would have happened, right? It's always interesting
meditate,
to think
Tony?
About it. Say again?
Do you meditate?
Not in a classical sense, but I reflect often. That's sort of a form of meditation,
of
maybe.
Course. Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. But not to put my sense sort of in a transcendental state, or I don't, you know, practice it that much. But I, you know, I exercise very regularly, and I do some, you know, yoga, Pilates exercises in the morning, and you know, that's a sort of a time of reflection to some extent.
Yeah, definitely this, we can call it meditation at the end of the day.
Okay.
I would. Okay, thank you so much, Tony, for this amazing discussion. And I really, really hope that we can hear more good news soon related to the reverse of the aging process. Really, hopefully it's going in a more advanced stage, and we can have amazing news related to that. Thank
Great.
You.
Great. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I'm very hopeful and optimistic. Otherwise, I wouldn't be a scientist.
I like that.
Great. Well, it was very nice talking to you. Thanks for your interest.
Thank you, Tony, so much.
Wow. What a conversation. Thank you so much, dear Tony, for all the inspiring information. I really wish you all the best with your projects and can't wait to hear more what's coming soon. For more inspiring interviews, head it over on Spotify, Google Podcast, iTunes, or wherever you are listening now. I have more surprises coming soon. If you like today's show, please share it with your friends, family, or community. I'm Krina, and you've been listening to the podcast How Can I Heal with Krina Okumus.